May I'm at an associate for 2019-99 for cost to them, turn your name, cover sharing up, set up bills, 1225-694-897-8022-249, Title 5. We're sharing the possible work session up, set up bills, 2133-697-5.
In the Senate Committee on Revenue. We have scheduled a public hearing on Senate Bill 1275, 694, 897, 680, 672, 249, 505, and a public hearing on the work session, Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 2133.
I don't have an agenda. We're scheduled.
We know you have an agenda, Senator. Don't give us that stuff.
Not a printed one in front of me for this committee. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, this is the one we were... All right. Representative Jensen is here on House Bill 2133, that's correct. So we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2133. And Mr. Waters, do you have a brief summation of that? And then we'll hear from Representative Jensen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2133 creates a refundable personal and corporate income tax credit based upon what's called a claim of right income adjustment. Under current law, deduction from taxable income is allowed or a claim of right income, but not a credit. This change under House Bill 2133 would make the treatment for right income adjustments more in line, more consistent with the treatment under federal law.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Representative Jensen, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Miller and members of the committee. Pleasure to be with you, and I really appreciate your hearing this bill, and I appreciate hearing my particular impression. It is an amendment that is comes out as Dash 2 amendment. And my apologies to you to begin with, that when I wrote up my written testimony, I didn't realize there had been a Dash 1 amendment, and I wrote mine up as a Dash 1 amendment that should be the Dash 2 on it. And it is, too, then the Dash 2 amendment that I am most concerned, but I think my comments will probably cover the basic issue of the bill. I urge your support of House Bill 2133 with the Dash 2 amendments. And I suggest to you that, in at least my opinion, that this bill and the amendment is about fairness and consistency. Occasionally taxpayers are required to pay back income they've received and paid taxes on earlier in the year. Under federal law, taxpayers may be entitled to claim a credit against their tax liability if they must repay the income. In contrast, Oregon law allows only a deduction from future income. This bill would create a provision similar to federal law. And I came to this concerned about this issue because of a constituent that called me that had received $16,000 plus or minus some change from PERS disability retirement. And the constituent had worked more than the number of hours that were allowed under the law and therefore had to repay to the state of Oregon the $16,000. Subsequently, he was able to get, luckily, the $3,000 that he paid to the federal government in income tax back from the federal government, but was unable to get the state income tax back. The only way that he could get anything back as far as state income tax was to claim a line item deduction in the next year's tax period. In light of the fact that there was no tax liability for this person in that year, it was impossible for them then to ever recover any income, is that tax money that has been paid, state tax. And with the committee's indulgence, I would like to suggest that this country was at least a revolution for this country, and our freedom was based in part on taxation without representation. And today, I think what we're looking at here is not a taxation without representation, but a taxation without income. And that seems to me grossly unfair, and I urge your support of this amendment and this bill. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Beautifully said.
Other questions? We thank you very much for your support.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate the opportunity to hear.
Susan Browning.
Mr. Chairman, I'm the committee for the record. I'm Susan Browning with the Department of Revenue. House Bill 2133 is the Department of Revenue bill. I believe Representative Jensen and Ed Waters explained it quite thoroughly to you. It basically comes up as an issue when an individual has to repay income, and on the federal level, as Representative Jensen explained, you can get a credit. But as the state law works, you can only take a deduction. So if you don't have sufficient income, you really cannot get your state income tax back. We introduced this and asked that this be introduced because we did know of similar taxpayers have similar problems to representative Jensen's constituents, and it doesn't seem appropriate that the individual shouldn't be able to get back their income tax that they paid in because of the way the system works technically at the state level. So in essence, on Section 2 of the bill, it establishes the credit. Section 3 is just a provision that prevents a double benefit. You can't take a deduction as well as a credit. So Section 3 of the bill. And then Section 5 of the bill just states that it's applicable to corporations as well as personal income taxpayers. Representative Jensen worked with him on the Dash 2 amendments, and in essence, that makes it the bill effective starting January 1st of tax year 1998. The current bill as written is tax year January 1st, 2000, but the 1998 would take care of Representative Jensen's constituents that have this problem right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about 42133. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Are there questions?
Sure.
Senator Martinez.
Thank you. Do we have a Dash 1 amendment?
We will have in due course.
Oh, we have that legal phrase in some kind of sense.
Senator Bryant.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
We have the past 2 amendments, and those are the ones that are going to check on the declaration. The Dash 1 amendments are not available today.
Okay.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2133? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2133. And just for the advice of members, we will come back to this bill when the exact ones are available, and we will expect to take some action. All right, now we'll return to our schedule here, and we will see this. Before we get to that, let me move out of order just briefly here and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 694. Minutes. Are you playing around? Okay, Mr. Waters. There's a gentleman I want to testify on this. That's the reason I opened it. Mr. Dickinson, are you here? All right, fine.
Welcome.
If you want to introduce yourself for our record and begin with your testimony, we appreciate that.
Yes, my name is Steve Dickinson. I'm the superintendent for Colton School District. And I picked up off the internet about 12:45 today that there was a hearing on 692, so I dropped 694 and tried and dropped everything and came down here. I would like to testify in support of Measure or Senate Bill 694, which relieves the mileage requirements for the small school correction formula. The current law says that I'll testify on the high school portion of this, says that for high schools that meet a small enrollment criteria, that they must be at least 10 miles from the next high school in order to qualify for small school correction money. I believe that the reason for that back in the 80s, early 80s, and was when the consolidation effort was coming, was to not provide financial incentive for districts that were close together, for schools that were close together, to remain apart and to encourage consolidation. It's meant that is older. I know that since the 1950s, there were about 450 school districts in the state. There's about 198 school districts now. Colton doesn't qualify for small schools correction formula because Colton High School is 9 miles from Malala High School. If Colton High School were 10 plus miles from Malala High School, we would qualify for an additional $338,000 in small schools correction money according to the current formula. What we see as inequitable about this is that the difference of 1 1/10 miles makes that significant of a funding difference in schools, where the purpose for small school correction is to recognize that districts that have small enrollment do not have the economy of scale in order to provide programs for students. And what I wanted to do was just very briefly explain to you from the standpoint of those that might say that districts that on the wrong side of the current number of school funding, the Republican caucus is supporting $4.725 billion, that they just need to spend less because they're not being as efficient. And that was a comment, not a direct quote, an interpretation of a quote by Representative Snodgrass that I heard last week in the House. Since Measure 5, Colton School District has had to cut its special ed director, it's cut all the music teachers in the district. It's got all the media specialists in the district, it's got all the art specialists in the district, and all the PE specialists in the district. We've reduced in custodian time, we've reduced in counselor time. For 2 years, we eliminated athletics. and Booster Club raised $55,000 for that. So we've seen a general downward spiraling, plus since the late 1980s, when the local populace were able to vote on the money available, our cash carryover position has reduced from over $800,000. Right now, projected cash carryover of about $150,000 for next year. We should be, by proper budgeting methods, we should be about $250,000 at the minimum. Despite that, we've been able to raise test scores, and our assessment test scores continue to raise, and we've been beginning to be recognized for quite a few very positive things happening. We've written grants for technology and have actually done a $300,000 technology project with just $55,000 of that being spent out of district general funds.
Mr. Dickinson, I can interrupt. First of all, I appreciate you being here in terms of hard time, and I were impressed by your testimony as we were both members of the Education Subcommittee on Ways and Means. What I wanted to tell you is that part of our process here deals with deadlines for certain concepts that have to be introduced, and this bill was placed on our agenda today because we wanted to make sure we preserved this as something we could pursue at another time. I was informed today by the sponsor of this measure that the concept embodied in Senate Bill 694 is being worked into House Bill 2607, sponsored by Representative Simmons, and we would expect to see that bill probably come to the Senate. And that would be, my guess, the vehicle that will incorporate this idea. So I don't want to deny you the chance to give us this good information, but it might be premature for this committee.
Okay, could I make a comment?
Absolutely.
I am aware of that, and House Bill 607 was heard once in March. And since then, I've been in contact with Representative Strobeck's office, and Representative Strobeck has indicated that he's not willing to bring that bill back up for a public hearing, that he is talking about wrapping it in with several other bills and putting it together. My concern is if this bill gets wrapped in with, I think ESD equity was one of them, and I don't know what the other one is. It may be something to do with funding for Portland. But we're the little guys, and we might get lost in the big issue. That's why I wanted to make sure this one was going to proceed on its own. I was hoping that it would, because I'm really concerned that one's going to get buried in committee and will never get even to the House floor.
So having scheduled this for a hearing today and having had a hearing of whatever length, we have this idea available to us for further discussion at a later date. And so we appreciate you bringing your attention to this bill and also to the load that's being taken on by 2607. And since I'm understanding that process, we'll try to do justice to the idea in 694.
Yes, sir. So I can depend upon watching for another hearing on this.
If 2607 is either bogged down, I mean, it's not just my decision, but what the members here believe about the importance of 694 standing alone.
Okay, thank you.
We would
see Senator Hart back again.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate
it. I think you were at Ways and Means when the Helix leadership people were there. Maybe not.
Okay. I missed it because I missed a very short notification.
Okay,
it happened to miss.
Well, Senator Nelson has the Helix district, 147 students. And I think they're in the same position that you are. And so I know Senator Nelson is very interested in this. Who's your state senator?
Our state senator is Senator Shannon. And she's expressed to the Colton community that she would support this. And Representative Beyer is the co-sponsor of House Bill 2607.
So would you keep in contact with those two legislators and help extract this?
We talked with them just last week.
I need to talk to them every day these days.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Appreciate it.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 694? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 694.
All right, we will move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 1275.
Mr. Phillips, would
you like to bring the first wave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips with Senate Communications at Nike. Today, in our first wave, we will have Matt Evans from Executive Director of Oregon Tax Research, Dale McAfee from ESCO, Dennis Peterson from MACI. Dennis is the Corporate Tax Director, and Gary Odegaard from MACI will be here to answer the questions that you might have. Craig Hanneman from Willamette Industries, who's been working with us on this, informed my office this morning that he had to be in Portland today or else he would get killed. I didn't ask any more details himself, but there might be other hearings that he could work out. In the audience, obviously, is Representative AOI and AEA, which I'm sure have interest in this measure from a different perspective. The question I pose to you today, gentlemen, is how should we examine Oregon's tax policy as it applies to four factors. Those factors would be economic development and growth, economic stability and diversity, competitiveness on a global scale, and how do we stimulate investment. The answer to that question, or that series of questions, is one of change, as represented in Senate Bill 1275, a single sales factor for tax calculations. The question that really bogged down when I was in your chair and before me and bailed them down session after session talking about tax policy is how do you want Oregon's economy to be structured for the long term, 5, 10, 15, 25 years out? Are we going to be a service economy? Or are we going to be a service economy that includes retail, commercial, industrial, and manufacturing? And how should that best be structured across the state from an economic standpoint and economic development? When double-weighted sales was an issue, I was served on this committee. And I believe Oregon was slow to respond, and as a result, didn't take the benefits that we could have. When the unitary tax was adopted in 1983, I was first in the legislature, and we were slow to respond there, although Governor Giacomo made a special session and caught us back up. We have the opportunity to move this session. We can keep pace with Texas, Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio, and other states that are considering it. I would ask you to consider those questions and the information you're going to receive from legislative revenue through the Department of Revenue as you listen to what Matt and others have to say. This is an issue of grave importance. It will be lost in the massive shuffle of bills that are there. The question is, and you have to balance it with the immediate revenue impact of this biennium and how that revenue impact will be carried forward, not just on a snapshot of today, but of a living trend that addresses growth for the long term. That concludes my comments, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Matt to come forward for his presentation, and after that, Dale and Dennis have some material for you, and then Gary and the rest of us will be open to questions, if that's okay.
That'll be just fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll bring up your new assistant.
Sure, I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Tax Research. Our OTR was created more than 60 years ago. Our mission is to encourage efficient and economical government through research and public education. We are a nonpartisan organization which seeks to provide information to policymakers and the public on which they can base decisions. Senate Bill 1275 provides this committee with a number of opportunities. We detailed some of these in our recent publication, Single Factor Sales Apportionment, an Economic Development Incentive for Oregon's Future. Each of you has previously received a copy of this report, and I brought another one along today and had to include as part of my prepared testimony. The structure of state taxation of corporate income is changing. It has been for most of this decade. Driving this change has been unprecedented competition for new plants and expansion of existing plants across the country. Although it is certainly not their only consideration, businesses look carefully at state tax structures when seeking to locate facilities. National accounting firms are aggressively counseling business clients on state and local taxes as a factor to consider when planning new locations. Legislatures are increasingly seeking out tax policies to promote broad economic development rather than creating special programs to attract or retain certain kinds of businesses. One of the most common strategies is an alteration of the multi-state income tax apportionment formula. Legislatures across the country have realized that by adopting a super-weighted or single sales factor formula, they can create a significant economic development advantage over other states. OTR first reported on the shift to the single sales factor 1 year ago. Since that time, seven states have begun seriously considering shifting to a single sales factor. Should they do so, they would join the eight states that currently have either a single sales factor or weight sales more than 50%. An interesting case study of a state looking to make this change is Minnesota. That state first went to a super-weighted sales factor of 70% in 1939. This year, the Minnesota legislature is considering going to a single sales factor. Although they are neutral on the bill, the Minnesota Taxpayers Association reports that the state is almost forced to make this change. Why? Minnesota's neighbors, Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, and Nebraska, are already at or near single factor, and Wisconsin will be shortly as well. Minnesota has found itself unable to compete for plant locations and expansions. Now, because Minnesota has allowed itself to fall behind its neighbors on this issue, the best they can hope for is a level playing field. As Dan Salamone, the executive director of NTA, told me this morning, it's like an arms race. The economic development impact of the move to super-weighted or single sales factor formulas is already being felt. In 1997, according to Site Selection, there were 10,481 plant locations or expansions in the United States. The seven states with single or super-weighted sales factors had an average of over 500 new and expanded facilities. The 24 states with a double-weighted sales factor averaged less than half that many. The remaining states with equal factors or no state income tax on businesses at all had one-tenth as many. The clear evidence is that states with single or super-weighted sales factors have a considerable advantage over states that do not.
Perhaps most striking is what the site selection data tells us about the competitive position of our own state. Again, there were 10,481 plant locations or expansions in the entire United States in 1997. Of these, Oregon garnered 13, 12/100ths of 1%. Robert Audi, a corporate location expert with a large accounting firm in Chicago, recently noted that Oregon is marginally competitive nationally because of our high corporate income tax. In 1997, Oregon had the 17th highest corporate income tax collection per capita. Two of our neighboring states, Washington and Nevada, do not tax corporate income at all. The other two, Idaho and California, have the same factor formulas that Oregon does. We are currently reasonably competitive with Idaho. In the site selection study, Idaho managed only 8 plant locations and expansions. However, we're at a considerable disadvantage with respect to our other neighbors. Washington had 81 plant locations and expansions in 1997, Nevada 166, and California 973. Now a word about potential revenue impacts. Both of us strongly disagree with the revenue impact statement issued today by the Legislative Revenue Office. With all due respect to the LRO, they have managed to find something no other organization studying single sales factor apportionment has. Oregon's own history with apportionment factors argues against a negative revenue impact from S-1275. The last time Oregon changed its factors, during the 1989 legislative session, the same Legislative Revenue Office predicted a neutral fiscal impact. However, between 1991 and 1994, after the new double-weighted sales factor was in effect, the net tax on apportioned returns increased 84%, while the number of apportioned filers increased only 12%. Perhaps even more instructive is what happened to actual Oregon corporate income tax collections. After the double-weighted sales factor formula was in effect, Oregon corporate income tax collections grew 18% in the 1991-93 biennium, 65% in the 1993-95 biennium, and 19% in the 95-97 biennium, doubling in just 6 years. For the same biennium, the gross state product was growing only 12%, 17%, and 17%, ahead of totals only 50%, half as fast as corporate income tax collections. While we do not believe that the significant outperformance of corporate tax collections versus growth in the economy was due solely to the change to a double-weighted sales factor formula, we do believe that corporate tax collections would have been lower under the old equal weightings. Naturally, as states have begun considering a shift, or shifting to single sales factor formulas, independent studies have been done on the potential fiscal impacts. Austin Goolsbee and Edward Mayhew of the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business provided the Minnesota Taxpayers Association with information on the impact of that state's potential move from 70 to 100% sales. Professors Goolsbee and Maydu found that the move would create 9,000 new jobs in the manufacturing sector and an additional 35,000 jobs in the non-manufacturing sector of the Minnesota economy. They further found that these new jobs would create a minimum of $43 million in new individual income tax collections annually. Just as with the LRO estimate, the Minnesota Department of Revenue claimed the corporate income tax revenue loss and failed to take into consideration any offsetting increase in personal income tax collections. The LRO estimate honestly states that this analysis ignores any positive impact on state revenues resulting from possible increased business activity. OTR produced a study similar to the University of Chicago study for Minnesota, which finds significant new business activity and thousands of new jobs would be created. Oregon is proposing... marginally competitive nationally because of our high corporate income tax. In 1997, Oregon had the 17th highest corporate income tax collections per capita. Two of our neighboring states, Washington and Nevada, do not tax corporate income at all. The other two, Idaho and California, have the same factor formulas that Oregon does. We are currently reasonably competitive with Idaho. In the site selection study, Idaho managed only 8 plant locations and expansions. However, we're at a considerable disadvantage with respect to our other neighbors. Washington had 81 plant locations and expansions in 1997. Nevada 166, and California 973. Now a word about potential revenue impacts. Most of our strongly disagrees with the revenue impact statement issued today by the Legislative Revenue Office. With all due respect to the LRO, they have managed to find something no other organization studying single sales factor apportionment has. Oregon's own history with apportionment factors argues against a negative revenue impact from S-1275. The last time Oregon changed its factors, during the 1989 legislative session, the same Legislative Revenue Office predicted a neutral fiscal impact. However, between 1991 and 1994, after the new double-weighted sales factor was in effect, the net tax on apportioned returns increased 84%, while the number of apportioned filers increased only 12%. Perhaps even more instructive is what happened to actual Oregon corporate income tax collections. After the double-weighted sales factor formula was in effect, Oregon's corporate income tax collections grew 18% in the 1991-93 biennium, 65% in the 1993-95 biennium, and 19% in the 95-97 biennium, doubling in just 6 years. For the same biennium, the gross state product was growing only 12%, 17%, and 17%, and a total of only 50%, half as fast as corporate income tax collection. While we do not believe that the significant outperformance of corporate tax collections versus growth in the economy was due solely to the change to a double-weighted sales factor formula, we do believe that corporate tax collections would have been lower under the old equal weightings. Naturally, as states have begun considering a shift, or shifting to single sales factor formulas, independent studies have been done on the potential fiscal impacts. Austin Goolsbee and Edward Nadeau of the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business provided the Minnesota Taxpayers Association with information on the impact of that state's potential move from 70 to 100% sales. Professors Goolsbee and Nadeau found that the move would create 9,000 new jobs in the manufacturing sector and an additional 35,000 jobs in the non-manufacturing sector of the Minnesota economy. They further found that these new jobs would create a minimum of $43 million in new individual income tax collections annually. Just as with the LRO estimate, the Minnesota Department of Revenue claimed a corporate income tax revenue loss and failed to take into consideration any offsetting increase in personal income tax collections. The LRO estimate honestly states that this analysis ignores any positive impact on state revenues resulting from possible increased business activity. OCR, a study similar to the University of Chicago study from Minnesota, would find significant new business activity and thousands of new jobs would be created. Oregon is proposing to make an even more dramatic move than Minnesota, providing even more incentive for business in Oregon to expand and for others to locate here. The University of Chicago did a similar study for the state of Illinois when it was considering moving to the single sales factor. As with Minnesota, the potential positive impact was found to be substantial. After 3 years, total job growth was expected to be 3%, with additional state revenue generated of $200 million. Again, this is substantially at odds with LRO's estimate for S-1275. Perhaps most surprising is the assertion that, quote, it seems likely that the time required to execute business expansion would probably not allow significant growth in income tax collections to occur before the 2003-05 biennium. The LRO contends that businesses in Oregon will take up to 5 years to make expansion decisions, whereas disinterested observers believe businesses in Minnesota and Illinois will begin expanding immediately. The Legislative Revenue Office was unable to correctly estimate the impact of the last change in Oregon factors. The impact was positive when LRO was neutral. Now LRO tells us S-1275 will be negative, while every other credible source says the impacts in other states will be positive. OGR expects passage of S-1275 will have a positive impact on job creation and plant expansion and location in Oregon, as it has had and will have in other states adopting the single sales factor formula. The economic development benefits available from passage of S-1275, however, will not be available forever. If we delay, Oregon will find itself facing this very same issue again in the not-too-distant future. If this committee declines to confront this issue in this session, you may find yourselves confronting it as Minnesota is, just trying not to lose any more ground. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions now.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thanks, Rita. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Peterson. I'm the Corporate Tax Director at Nike. Now that Matt has given me the background on single factor portion, I thought it would be best if I spend my time talking to you from the business perspective as to what this change would mean for businesses. This bill would send a strong message to businesses in Oregon, or business in general, that Oregon wants investment and employment, and in particular wants companies to maintain significant facilities in Oregon. This message is conveyed because the bill would change our corporate income tax to favor in-state companies over out-of-state companies. The Legislative Revenue Office report does not accurately portray what this bill does. The bill will shift the tax burden from in-state companies to out-of-state companies. The impact is not driven by the magnitude of the company's sales factor, as the LOR report implies. Actually, the net change in tax that occurs is driven more by the location of property and payroll. Over the long run, the tax incentives created by this bill will spur economic development and consequently increase tax revenues for Oregon. LRO was not able to quantify the positive economic impact of this bill. Other states and studies have done so. I think Matt's testimony adequately demonstrated that the studies that have shown that this type of change will, in fact, have a positive impact and then create tax revenues. As part of our package that we're submitting to, we have copies of some of this material that will support those contentions. In company search for a state in which to locate a new plant or facility, the tax burden associated with the alternative states being considered as one of the several factors looked at. In the remaining time I have with you, I'd like to discuss how this bill would change the way that businesses view Oregon as a prospective location for a new facility. Let's look at it from three different perspectives. First, from the perspective of an in-state company. Secondly, as an out-of-state company. And third, let's talk about the view from other states. And looking at it this way, I think we can best demonstrate that Oregon should not delay in passing this bill. First, the view from in-state businesses. Companies headquartered in Oregon, such as Nike, as well as companies with substantial presence in Oregon, like Intel and Hewlett Packard, are the types of companies I'm talking about as being in-state. Keep in mind that these companies typically file and pay taxes in virtually every state in the U.S. The first point I want to make is that these companies are incurring higher taxes in states which have already adopted a single-factor formula. For example, Nike's income tax liability in Texas is more than double what it would have been under the equal-weighted formula. In Illinois, our tax will go up about 25% once the single-factor formula is adopted. And so by doing nothing, Oregon is effectively allowing in-state companies to be hurt. The remedy for this is for Oregon to adopt the single-factor formula. Now let's look at how in-state companies decide where to locate their new facilities. If a company like Nike or Intel were comparing Oregon to Texas as two possible sites for a new facility, how do you suppose the state income taxes would impact this decision? I'd like to talk you through this analysis. If a new plant were located in Texas, our Texas tax liability would not change because Texas uses this to fill factor already, whereas our Oregon liability would go down. That may seem not intuitive, so I might repeat that, but if a company like Nike were to put a new facility into Texas, our Oregon liability would actually drop, but our liability in Texas would not change at all. So in essence, I think what we can see here is that Oregon is essentially providing an incentive to locate in Texas in that scenario. On the other hand, if we were to put the new plant facility in Oregon, our Oregon liability would go up, but then our Texas liability would remain the same. So no matter how you look at it, the Oregon income tax law gives the advantage to Texas. In fact, it might be characterized as subsidizing the investment in Texas. Again, the remedy here is for Oregon to adopt the single-factor sales method. Once Oregon has done this, it will be competitive with states in Texas and Illinois and actually have an advantage over many other states such as California, Washington, and Utah. Now let's turn and look at it from the point of view of an out-of-state business. And by out-of-state, I mean companies that sell to customers located in Oregon, but which have their principal base operations outside Oregon. There's literally hundreds of these companies that include such companies as General Motors, Procter & Gamble, and all the major drug companies and so on. Under the bill, these companies will be the losers because they will pay more than that. But keep in mind that in the event their home state has already gone to the single factor method, these companies are benefiting by a local tax break. So in this case, I think the best way to characterize this change is just that Oregon would be putting these companies, or to be creating a level playing field for these companies. So with the enactment of this bill, when it comes time to make an investment decision by these out-of-state companies, Oregon would come right out as another top candidate. This happens, again, as we've already talked here, because by rotating the facility in Oregon, we would incur no additional tax, whereas with other state liabilities would tend to go down, as if the states have not adopted this method. Now let's turn and talk from the point of view of other states if Oregon would adopt this Senate Bill 1275. This would certainly get the state's attention, because states are very competitive in their solicitation of business investment. There's a trend, and some may have described it as actually a race among the states to adopt the single-factor sales method. Many states have already done so, and several others like Oregon have had it currently under consideration. The point here, I think Matt made it also, is that the winners among these states will be those that adopt first, and the losers are going to be those states that don't adopt or that wait and adopt later, because they have to do this to say even with the other state. In summary, I'd just like to say that the proactive adoption of the single-factor portion method would work to do three things. First, it would retain existing in-state companies. Second, it would encourage new facilities and employment in Oregon at both in-state companies as well as out-of-state companies. And third, it would send a message throughout the U.S. that Oregon is open for business. Please read and thank you for support staff and Bill 1275. I'll see you in a month. I'm glad to take the question.
Thank you. Why don't we have Dale do your presentation and we may ask the question.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Dale McCaffey, and I'm Corporate Tax Manager for ESCO Corporation. I've been working in the Corporate Tax Department for 25 years, 20 of them with ESCO. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about my favorite tax topic, corporate income taxation, and that fine little insignificant area called the Corporate Income Tax Apportionment Formula. I realize that many of you don't share my lifelong passion for the details and trivia associated with corporate income taxation, but I am here to put a new spin on some novel ideas about corporate income taxation. It has been said that the best income tax system is one which extracts the most revenue with the least amount of complaints. Another measure of a fine income tax program is a tax system that doesn't tax me and doesn't tax me, that taxes a fellow over there behind the tree. Our tax task today is to determine which companies in Oregon should pay more tax and which companies doing business in Oregon should pay less tax. Let me begin by saying that all business taxpayers want to pay their fair share of taxes. What is not often talked about is what is a business in terms of fair share. Companies such as ESCO have been in business in Portland since 1913, find family wage jobs, paying property taxes, contributing to charitable causes,
but this is stating in the economic well-being of Portland and Oregon, and always being there for the city and the state, that ESCO be taxed as much as a foreign corporation. That is one that's not headquartered in Oregon. It only sells into Oregon. A foreign corporation that sells into Oregon only takes revenue out of the state, does not pay property taxes or any of the other things that come either manufactures and supplies jobs in the state to the state and the community. Now, who should pay a heavier income tax burden? It seems obvious to me that a tax system should be designed to promote economic activities inside the state and not in other competing states. Under Oregon's current system, the F those in Oregon pay the heavier Oregon state income tax burden relative to the foreign company. Why does Oregon penalize its best business taxpayer citizens and encourage foreign companies to put their manufacturing plants in other states that don't hurt them economically through the other states' income tax system? If Oregon does want to maintain a strong economy and low unemployment, well, why won't we encourage, through the corporate income tax process, manufacturing companies locating in Oregon? I would like to say today that there is a way to favor homegrown industries, but also the ones with manufacturing facilities in the state over robber baron companies that just sell into the state and take their profits to other states with more favorable income tax programs, but they build their plans and create jobs. So it seems, from an economic development point of view, you would want to stop this inequity and do what is best for Oregon companies. I hope I have your attention and your interest in helping correct this economic impediment, because it is truly doable. And the best part is the federal court that says the proposal I'm about to make does not discriminate against these foreign companies. Thus, it is okay to tax the heck out of the robber baron companies. How do we do this marvelous tax sleight of hand and punish the economically bad guys by giving incentives to the economically enhanced good guys to build their plants here and employ Oregonians? Here's where I get technical on you. I dive headfirst into the swamp of corporate income tax apportionment formula. What is it? Why do we need it? How does it work? All very good questions that I will try to answer. The corporate taxpayer begins with their federal taxable income, just like you do when you have to figure your personal Oregon income tax liability. But unlike you, a corporation may do business in as many as 50 states. You and your personal income tax would not like to report 100% of your income to all 50 states. You would be taxed on the same income in all states. Corporate taxpayers do not have to report 100% of all their federal taxable income, but only a portion of it. A portion of income due to each state is calculated by using the corporate income tax apportionment formula. The original concept was that the formula would contain three factors, each with an equal weight to it. The factor means representative of the business activity with the payroll in the state divided by total payroll, the property in the state divided by total property, and the sales in the state by total sales. Now, it's not hard to see if you have no employees in the state, you have no payroll, and this factor becomes zero with that kind of a weight in the formula. Similarly, if there is no manufacturing facility in the state, the property factor drops to zero. The sales factor, in my example, is then divided by three, and the portion of federal income tax is smaller than the manufacturing entities in the state. Thus, for years, the robber barons have been taxed at a smaller relative income level than the homegrown manufacturers. In 1991, the Oregon legislature finally understood the inequity of the system and went to double weighted sales factor, tipping the scales a little more toward the home team. There was a surprising result because corporate tax revenues went through the ceiling. The increase in personal income tax revenues was also quite impressive. Both of these strange tax results can be explained by increased economic activity and the shift in the tax burden to the robber baron companies. Those companies selling into Oregon far outnumber the companies benefiting under the change, plus they are much bigger corporations. The ones selling into Oregon are probably the Fortune 500 companies. The ones that are benefiting are the ones that are sitting before you. So their contributions to the Oregon tax system increased with the 91 change to a much larger extent. And it's an absolute dollars, which total tax revenue. And was handed out as incentives to the home team companies who carry the Oregon economy on their back. There was also added plant sidings, which increased the personal income in the state, and thus revenues should be the double impact. I'm here today to ask you to support Senate Bill 1275, which creates a single sales factor apportionment formula. Other states are doing it for economic development. Oregon should do it also. The benefits, in my opinion, are twofold. The first is flat-out more control of corporate income tax revenue. If on a net basis, there will be a windfall to Oregon. Illinois is projecting a $200 million increase when they adopt it. Second, there will be more jobs, plus more personal income tax revenue, and a more stable economy. Please vote for the change and send an economic message around the country that Oregon wants manufacturing plants in the state. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Let me ask a little bit about the activity of the other states. Right now, how many have adopted the tax scheme that you are proposing in Senate Bill 1275? Put in the package that we handed to you with a map that's colored by those states. And you can find that quickly near the top.
Okay.
Some of the matters here may have an actual number, but it's okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gary Odegaard, and I'm the U.S. Region Tax Manager for Nike, Inc. And I put together the map before you. It's changed slightly since it was published, but the changes are that Virginia now has gone from an equally weighted to a double weighted, and Minnesota currently has legislation pending to go from the 70% factor to the 100% sales factor. Is your question exactly how many states?
Yeah, it's eight according to the...
There's eight currently with, I think our criteria was super weighted with greater than 50%, but there's no state less than 50. Detail as a super weighted sales factor state. 38 that either have greater than 50 or greater.
And also, I think the testimony was seven states were contemplating...
Those are the blue ones on the map.
And you don't even have Oregon on your map, are you contemplating?
Well, when we published it, we didn't know if the bill was always brought forward. So
because I'm trying to get a sense for that word, because sometimes somebody's idea that hasn't either been drafted or had a hearing is counted as contemplating or selling.
I believe that the ones in the blue are the ones that have legislative action pending. I guess you could include Oregon in that, so they would be nine states.
Okay. I'm almost interested maybe in having Mr. Evans come back and perhaps Mr. Peterson is also there. Just a little more comment on your review of our revenue impact analysis. I gather you have this. You've seen this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have.
Can you just review it again, the specific disagreement? Recognizing, as I'm sure you do, that we need to be a bit cautious. And also, I think we always have this debate about static versus dynamic. And it seems to be the role of government to be stuck in the static sometimes, as you know. And, and I think we would be critical sometimes if we were overactive in predicting behavior, even if it, in the minds of many, would be quite obvious. I do know that this statement here says this analysis ignores any positive impacts on state revenues resulting from possible increased business activity. That's something I think you noted that in your review should have been somehow quantified and would balance out or certainly make up for any congested revenue loss. Is that my understanding, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. That's essentially the concern. And that's not necessarily a criticism of the Legislative Revenue Office. I mean, they typically do not do what you refer to as dynamic analyses of changes in the tax code or other bills that come before this body or the other house. And that's our chief concern, is because when you look at the studies that have been done about other states who are contemplating going to the single sales factor, you have people who aren't in the process looking at this from the outside, finding pretty dramatic differences in behavior and, in fact, increased funds coming into state coffers because of increasing business activity, which comes in two forms, either through corporate income tax collection increases or through personal income tax collection increases, because you've got additional jobs being created, more people making more money, paying more taxes.
You know, given the analysis that you all concur with, and having had the experience of being on Ways and Means, maybe the thing you ought to do is go out in the hallway on a daily basis and solicit some of the spenders that are here routinely, tell them you got a new gold mine. But that's just it. Are there other comments, questions, Senator Byer?
Your criticism is that the revenue forecast only includes the adjustments in current known revenues, sort of the winners and losers, and would not take into consideration, as I think they said, new plant expansions or new locations.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, that's essentially correct. I mean, I believe the way this revenue estimate was arrived at is they simply took the amount of revenue that was generated in the most recent year for which complete records are available, and reapplied the new factor formulas to those numbers, and which is how they operate. And again, I'm not criticizing the method in which this was done, simply that the conclusion is incomplete because it does not take into consideration the gains that Oregon would get because of increasing business activity in the state over time.
In a sense, I guess without all three of you, the sense would be that firms that are currently here, if their factor would change, would expand rapidly. Well, if you look at the study done from Union Bank, that was a study that indicated the amount of new facilities and plant expansions in 1997. The states with the super-weighted factors had over 50% of the total expansions that occurred in the United States. We don't even know exactly why, but the data supports that
that the property and the payroll is going to states that don't penalize the taxpayer for locating and expanding the property and payroll base.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byron, if I could respond to that. This bill, these provisions don't take effect until January 1st, 2000. Well, that's more than 6 months from now. And 6 months in a global economy such as the one we're in now is an eternity for business. Businesses are making the lightning decisions these days because they have to. If they don't move in to fill an area of opportunity that they see, somebody else is going to move in to fill it. This bill provides such an opportunity for businesses that are looking to locate in a place where they can be taxed solely on the amount of sales they make and not on the facilities that they have to build.
I guess that was an argument I was thinking about. How quickly that turnaround would take place. I would think that you're probably looking at least a year and more likely 18 to 24 months before you can see any quick impact. I mean, just the nature from my experience, by the time you start to make a decision to the time when you can get something built and constructed, it's going to take you 18 to 24 months.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byron, I was talking with Mr. Odegaard earlier today, and he indicated that the expansion of the Nike campus that's currently under construction has taken about 2 years from beginning to end. But that's not, an unreasonable estimate. But again, we've got 8 months here, essentially, until this even takes effect, and there are going to be companies around the nation that are considering relocating right now. This would make news for those companies and at the accounting firms that are responsible for advising them. And those decisions to locate are going to be made on an ongoing basis. And if they know Oregon is now on the table as a place with a single sales factor, we're going to be in the ballgame as opposed to being completely shut out of it.
Well, would it be your conclusion then that if we were to move to this but had an implementation date out there for years, that folks making a decision, seeing that, it would influence their decision? Less than the initial impact.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I would definitely say that if the companies would take that into consideration, you know, even if it was after 2 years or so, it's still, in making that decision, would consider Oregon to be a single factor state. Just because, as you said, it takes a year to build a facility, and then you're just almost there. So,
Mr. Chairman, I might add that property under construction isn't included in the sales factor, into the property factor, in the three factor formula in Oregon. So, as the property is being constructed, it wouldn't be a penalty until it was actually placed into service. Therefore, you may have some immediate thoughts towards building a plant, even if it wasn't going to take 1 to 2 years, and then at the point when the new law is it.
And
I guess I'd ask all three of you, the sense would be that firms that are currently here, if their factor would change, would expand rapidly?
Well, if you look at the study done from Union Bank, that was a study that indicated the amount of new facilities and plant expansions in 1997. The states with the super-weighted factors had over 50% of the total expansions that occurred in the United States. We don't even know exactly why, but the data supports that the property and the payroll is going to states that don't penalize the taxpayer for locating and expanding the property and payroll base.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byron, if I could respond to that. This bill, this provision, don't take effect until January 1st of 2000. Well, that's more than 6 months from now. And 6 months in a global economy such as the one we're in now is an eternity for business. Businesses are making lightning decisions these days because they have to. If they don't move in to fill an area of opportunity that they see, somebody else is going to move in to fill it. This bill provides such an opportunity for businesses that are looking to locate in a place where they can be taxed solely on the amount of sales they make and not on the facilities that they have to build.
I guess what I was thinking about how quickly that turnaround would take place. I would think that you're probably looking at least a year and more likely 18 to 24 months before you can see any quick impact. I mean, just the nature from my experience, by the time you start to make a decision to the time when you can get something built and constructed, it's going to take you 18 to 24 months.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byron, I was talking with Mr. Odegaard earlier today, and he indicated that the expansion of the Nike campus that's currently under construction has taken about 2 years from beginning to end. So that's not, an unreasonable estimate. But again, we've got 8 months here, essentially, until this even takes effect. And there are going to be companies around the nation that are considering relocating right now. This would make news for those companies and at the accounting firms that are responsible for advising them. And those decisions to locate are going to be made on an ongoing basis. And if they know Oregon is now on the table as a place with a single sales factor, we're going to be in the ballgame as opposed to being completely shut out of it.
So would it be your conclusion then that if we were to move to this that had an implementation date out there 2 years, that folks making the decision, seeing that, it would influence their decision?
less than the initial impact.
Mr. Chairman, I would definitely say that if the companies would take that into consideration, maybe the specter was out there 2 years or so, you'd still, in making that decision, would consider Oregon to be a single factor state. Just because, as you said, it takes a year to build a facility and then you shoot almost there. So,
Mr. Chairman, I might add that property under construction isn't included in the sales into the property factor and the three factor form in Oregon. So as the property is being constructed, it wouldn't be a penalty until it was actually placed into service. Therefore, you may have some immediate thoughts towards building a plant, even if it wasn't going to take 1 to 2 years. And then at the point when the new law, if it did in fact came new law, would be in effect at that point in time. So it could definitely impact an investment decision.
I would note that among those of us that are losers is California, and they had a fairly substantial piece of that pie and the growth in their study.
Other questions, Senator Snow?
Yes, I would like a little elaboration on the party testimony, Matt, regarding the history of 1989 and that series and what happened as a result. I didn't follow that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, so essentially what happened is the 1989 legislature changed the factors in Oregon. We were, at that time, we were equally weighted. That means it was one-third sales, one-third property, and one-third payroll. They said starting in 1991, we're going to go to 50% sales and 25% property and 25% payroll, and we figure out how much we're going to have in multi-state corporation. Well, at that time, the legislative revenue office came forward with an estimate that there would be essentially no impact on state revenues from making that change, from increasing the sales factor from 33% to 50%. Well, what actually happened was there was a tremendous amount of growth in corporate income tax collections from 1991, when those provisions first went into effect, through 1996. A total of 100% more money came in corporate income tax collections over that 6-year period than previously had come in. So there, and again, I don't believe that all of that was due to the fact that we changed these factors. I don't think that was because we had really dynamic economic growth during that period of time. Nonetheless, I think there was probably a positive economic impact and a positive revenue impact to the state because of that change when it was made.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator, so I might be able to add a little anecdote to that. I've had the advantage of leading several of these studies that have been conducted by independent parties, and the way that they look at states is either you're a market state or you're a producer state. And a market state would be a state, I believe, such as Oregon, where you're not heavily into the manufacturing sector. There's not a lot of concentration of property and payroll. If you were heavily weighted in your state, had large amounts of capital and payroll, and you move to this like a super weighted sales factor, it could be detrimental to your tax collection. And in a state that's simply a market state, where you're not heavily in as a manufacturer, but the concentration of property and capital and payroll, if you move to the sales, you would get an increase in revenue because it's the biggest factor of the out-of-state corporation. Maybe I'm confusing you, but like a company such as General Motors doesn't have any property and payroll in the state, but it has a significant amount of sales. So what happens if the property sales factor is 3% and they have virtually no payroll or property, the factor is going to double. It's gone from 50% to 100%, and the liability goes up accordingly. It doubles. So that's why I think that the questions, when Oregon moved from the equally weighted to the double weighted because it's a market state, because that's 42nd in manufacturing jobs, the sales factors were heavily weighted, it taxed the out-of-state corporations more heavily, and hence a revenue impact that was positive. And that's what I would anticipate if we move to a single-factor sales, because Oregon is still what I'd consider a market state.
Thank you, sir. I'm sure I followed you pretty closely on that, but has not that shifted quite a bit with the growth in manufacturing that we see, for instance, in Washington County? We've had a considerable expansion in manufacturing in the decade.
Well, not relative to the rest of the country. In 1997, we had the 10,000 or so plant expansions or the new plants or expansion of existing facilities. Of the 10,000, Oregon got 13, which is on the very, very bottom. So relative to the rest of the country, even though we have had new facilities within the state, such as Intel, it's still small relative to the manufacturing sector in the other states.
Thank you very much. Other questions? So, Roger, do you have other testimony you want to provide? Or?
No, I think we're just about done.
All right. Thank you all.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
again, Paul Phillips for Remington. I'd like to thank you all and for my deep appreciation for your listening to our testimony and make a couple of comments. I'd like you to review the corporate base. And Senator Hartung, I would call upon your memory. When we first met, it was in the late 70s, I think 76, 77. And think about those individuals that you worked with when you were in the legislature in the mid-70s and when I was with Senator Attia. Think about the downtown corporate community that we had in Portland. Think about the industrial base that we had around the state of Oregon. And look at where we are now and look at where we're heading 15, 20 years from now. And if you look at this map that Gary put together for you, and you say to yourself, the Midwestern heavy industrialized section and what they're changing to, and our position on the Pacific Rim, and who else is considering this, and how would we advantage ourselves in the long term? And think about the 1980s recession that we went through and the growth and expansion that we've seen in the 90s, and how we're going to position ourselves through 2010 and 2015. And you compare the information that you've been given by legislative revenue on the static view, and the information that they're going to give you on the top 50s, winners and losers. I think you're going to present that. And I'd like you to consider that was the last complete year of taxes that they gave, and that was 1996. Doesn't say partial year in 97. What happened in 1996? It was the best year we ever had. So you compare these things and look at this. It's important to consider what the changes have occurred since we first met in the late 70s, what happened in the 80s, what's going on in the 90s, not just from a one-year static perspective, and not just from the past 3 years, but where are you going to be 15 years from now? And we have offered, and I don't think I highlighted this in my opening statement, this bill is phased in. And we phased it in as a result of attempting to address the revenue issue that you have as a political issue to deal with. There are all sorts of ways to address that. And I think, Senator Starr, you raised an important issue. Where are you today and how would you do it? Senator Byer commented on whether we could do an implementation date and the signal that it would put out to other states. And moving forward, this session, this biennium, on something that may be a different formula, but in the same direction as what we suggested, but can address some of those issues, will soon be beneficial to the state. And I'll close with asking you to keep your mind's eye open to a creative solution to a difficult problem, and how tax policy is going to be formulated in the state so that we can make sure that we have a stable economy, an economy that grows, an economy that employs not just our kids, but our kids' kids. And that we can make sure when the legislature of 2015 shows up here, they're not talking again about how do we have a statewide economy, how do we have it not just from your district to your district and that belt in between, but how do we help the 13% of the population that are in eastern Oregon, how do we affect those people in southern Oregon, and how do we keep a manufacturing base that is good for the state, diversifies the economy, and moves us forward? And those are the questions I'd like you to look at, Senator and Mr. Chairman, as to how we can craft this and move forward as you listen to LOR. Legislative revenue, and you listen to the Department of Revenue, and you listen to the Department of Economic Development as they talk about this, because this is an important, you have the opportunity to move it forward, and I'd ask you to seize that opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz, to recognize Senator Byer.
Paul, has there been any look at sort of who the winners and losers would be in this for all your companies?
Just to you, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I think Mr. Waters is going to give you that comparison effect on the largest 50. Of Oregon taxpayers based on 1996. And I just would caution you, while that's valuable information, that is a one-year, again, snapshot of something, and it helps put it in perspective. I believe it was in 89 when we looked at changing, and at that time we were catching up, and it still was beneficial to say we had in-depth watches of a variety of materials, either 90 or 91 to test the effect. But this will at least give you an indication by segment, and I think Ed was planning to walk you through that when we were done. Is that right, Ed?
Mr. Chairman, can you actually provide some
quickly information if
have questions about it, I'd be happy to answer level interest. But basically, if you finish the pages, one has the effect on the top 50 corporate taxpayers. I read a
Well, Senator Byer, this came as a conversation that I had with the chair based on my past experience in this committee, although when I was on the House side, and actually seeing Mr. Warner testify in front of us in a different role when he was the working for the state in a different capacity. And we asked for some kind of analysis. The point being, if you look at all the material that Mr. Peterson provided you, and you look at the material that Mr. Evans provided you, and you look at the economic crystal ball of where you want the economy to look, what you want it to look like for job creation and other things from an economic development standpoint, this is clearly the direction to head in, and how you get there and over what period of time is the vexing decision that you're going to have to work through. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Arthur Ayer.
Good
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Dare. I'm the economist with the Oregon Economic Development Department. And I was asked to share with you some insights on the Oregon Economic Development Department's perspective on this bill. And I hope I will shed a little light on it, but I'm not sure that it will be a lot of light. I was just asked about this yesterday morning and haven't had a whole lot of time to catch up to speed on what the impacts of this bill might be. I haven't seen the official Legislative Revenue Office report, but I have received a copy of a spreadsheet that I believe contains most of the important information in there. So I believe I have a sense of what that static impact might be on tax revenues and industry sectors. And I have some questions that remain unanswered that I think raise some issues in my mind as to where we go from here with this bill. One of the questions that I'd like to address is this bill good for export-based growth? And as far as I can tell, it would be. But as the legislative revenue analysis shows, there are winners and losers, at least on a static basis. There are winners and losers in every industry sector, including manufacturing. And so one of the questions in my mind is, who are those manufacturers that would be hurt by this bill? What are their characteristics? Are they rural? Are they urban? Are they in distressed areas? Are they large? Are they small? Some of those questions remain in my mind, so it's a little bit difficult for me to know what the impact of this would be. There appears, again, from the static analysis, that there would be a net revenue impact, and if the bill were revenue neutral, presumably it would, again, be good for export-based growth and business. Under a situation where the bill reduced government revenue, obviously, then it raises the question of what is that going to do to government services and how does that translate back into business climate. If indeed over time the business sector grows because of this, which is certainly a possibility, then that could certainly have potentially positive impacts on government revenue and business climate. One other question I have is that because it puts more, obviously potentially more weight on sales, the issue of throwbacks becomes a bigger issue. Apparently sales obviously is leading the proportion and the apportionment factor or formula as 50% of the factor. This is put it at 100%, and the issue of throwbacks is one of those areas where I haven't had time to hear the feed on what that means to various companies selling to certain markets. But, apparently, and again, I haven't spent very long studying this, but the company selling into markets where they don't, where the company selling, the Oregon company selling to that market is not taxed, either because they don't have a location there, they don't have a presence there, or that market does not tax that activity in that market, that sale then becomes thrown back to Oregon and treated as an Oregon sale, as I understand it, for the apportionment formula. And that's, as I understand it, that's called a throwback. And I don't know if that is an important issue, but it's one that came up in my mind when I was looking through the insurance. And obviously that issue of throwbacks becomes a more important issue as the sales factor gets bigger. I guess one other issue is, does this bill or does the single sales tax formula fit in with our operations or our policy? I guess the way I would answer that is if we were dealing with a company that is interested in expanding or relocating to Oregon, or they're dealing with retention issues, and we could determine whether or not this particular law, this tax law, would be beneficial to that company, then I would guess we would emphasize that as a positive for Oregon. And at this point in time, I'm not sure how easy it would be for our development officers to make that determination and use this as a tool.
All right. Other questions? If it is, do you believe this would stimulate business activity in the state?
Clearly, this would make a difference for most every company that's a multi-state company. In some cases, apparently, it would be a benefit. In other cases, apparently, it would be a detriment. And so the question in my mind is, what is the long-term impact of that? I haven't had time to think that through and have enough information, actually, on which to make a decision.
Well, it would be helpful, I think, to this committee if you could continue to think on this.
All right.
Those unresolved issues, if you have, you can provide a response to that.
Yeah, I would say at this point, I think it is positive for export-based activities. And it's clearly that's the intent, and that appears to be the likely impact.
Well, be it as inclusive, expensive as you care to be in your analysis of this proposal, it would be helpful to this committee, and I would invite you to go beyond the static.
Okay.
Yes, I did. I think you're an inhibiting factor in a lot of things.
Right.
We all have some of us to be interested in.
Yep.
We are more opportunities for our citizens, and
right.
A lot of testimony that this would be a help.
Right. I'm sorry. I don't have more to share with you.
Oh, that might be. I the late holiday conversation for this hearing, and
that's right.
In the next
several days. Okay. Research that. I suppose that would be helpful as well.
All right. We'll make that happen.
Thank you, Senator Byer.
It would be helpful if, I know you can't get down into details, but if you're thinking through this, if you could, by industry or by type of industry, could you give some illustration for who might be helped and what that impact might be? I'm not so interested necessarily in the dollar amounts, or if you do it, that's great. I'm more interested in just the logic of what, in your perspective, looking at it as an economist and economic development, with winners and losers and why.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also have, I know there was a writer here from the Oregonian and who asked if this somehow makes news, some of those impacted companies, whether positive or negative, they might actually contact us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I noticed the representative from the Associated Oregon Industries is here, and perhaps some information can be forthcoming with respect to how their various members might view this proposal. Senator Byer?
I can help but sit here and think about the largest expanding industries in my district, which happened to be the RV industry, where the purchase price is $250,000 to about $3 million a unit.
They're all parked out.
That's a lot of money, right?
Thank you, Mr. Eric. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1275?
Yes.
Mr. Rodriguez, come on up.
Come up. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. In a situation where we move to a single-factor sale, in no case would it be detrimental to increase your property and payroll in the state, because it's no longer a component of the abortion factor. That's why states are moving to the single-factor sales to encourage jobs and capital accumulation in your state. Currently, as Mr. Pearson discussed, you have the Texas scenario, where if you invest, you put the new plant and the new jobs in Texas, what happens? There's no change in the Texas liability, but your Oregon tax liability goes down because of the property and payroll are in the denominator of the abortion factor. Okay? So there's a disincentive to invest in Oregon currently. It gets back to the Union Bank survey where the states, having a huge amount of new plants and expansions, were in the states where there was no tax penalty associated with employing new capital and jobs. It's pretty basic economic theory. So it's free from the tax component piece. I just want to clarify that one piece.
Thank you for that clarification. All right, if there's no one else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1275, we will close the public hearing. We thank all of you for coming and providing your information. We had hoped to work Senate Bill 2, but I think we will take that up next week if the Senate President will allow us the additional time. And since it's his bill, my guess is he will. So, yes. So we'll open a work session with Senate Bill 2 and announce that we'll schedule that for next week. Close the work session with Senate Bill 2. Now we have a number of matters we're just going to bring up simply for reservation here, and I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 897. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 897. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 680. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 680. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 672. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 672. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 249. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 249. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Is there anything further to come before the committee? I thank you all for your attendance, and we are...
close the public hearing on Senate Bill 672. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 249.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 249.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 505.
Is there anything further to come before the committee? I thank you all for your attendance, and we are...